Thank you very much for inviting me here. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to give the first talk so I can be done. So as you all know, I'm sure here, the dark matter makes up about 1/4 of the energy budget of the universe today, something like 5/6 of the non-relativistic matter. It also, as far as we know, is the load-bearing frame, the load-bearing structure for galaxy formation. However, we still don't know what the dark matter is. And so we have to explore every possible avenue, look under every possible stone to try and uncover what it is. So as the title may indicate, this talk will be a little bit of a mixed bag of different things. So at first I will talk about a dark matter particle, which is a subdominant dark matter particle, but it's a standard model particle, which is massive neutrinos. So they are not the dark matter. They are, as I said, a subdominant dark matter, and they are hot. And so they affect structure formation, and I will explain how one can compute their effect on structure formation. Then I will talk about dark matter interactions with standard model particles, and I will show you, first of all, how one can use the spectrum of the cosmic microwave background as a direct detection experiment, how one can set limits on these interactions from the spectrum of the CMB. And then I will talk about detection prospects for high redshift 21 centimeter fluctuations. And finally, I will conclude talking about a completely different kind of dark matter, which is a different possibility for dark matter, which is primordial black holes, and a recent paper we had in the group about the interesting possibility that LIGO could have detected dark matter. So let's start with neutrinos. This is work that I did in collaboration with Simeon Bird a couple of years ago at the IIS, and we're still working on it now. So neutrinos are the last standard model particle without a known mass. We know that they do have a non-zero mass. From Flavier oscillations, we have measured the differences of the squares of the mass eigenstates of neutrinos. However, this does not indicate, first of all, how the masses are arranged. We could have two light neutrinos and a heavier one, or vice versa, the so-called normal or inverted hierarchy. And also, it does not tell you the absolute scale of the neutrino mass. So we do have, if we assume that the lightest neutrino is massless, this gives you some absolute lower bound on the sum of the neutrino masses. And for the normal hierarchy, something like 0.06 electron volts, and the inverted hierarchy, something like 0.1 electron volt. We do have upper bounds, first of all, from beta decay experiments on the neutrino. Maybe I should be in the center instead of on the side, right? So on the neutrino electron mass, which is no more than about 2 electron volts. And from cosmological measurements, we have the most stringent upper bounds on the sum of the neutrino masses, something like a few tenths of an electron volt, and improving. So as you can see, the gap is closing, and the hope is that in the next decade or so, we will actually be able to measure the mass of neutrinos from cosmological experiments. That is, of course, provided we can understand sufficiently precisely the effect of neutrinos on cosmological observables, which is the point of this first part of the talk. So a few more basic facts about cosmic neutrinos. They decouple from the rest of the plasma about a second after the Big Bang. From there on, because they decouple while relativistic, they keep their relativistic Fermi-Dirac distribution. Here, the word relativistic just indicates something about the shape of the distribution, because neutrinos today are non-relativistic, which is why they are effectively a dark matter. However, they're not a cold dark matter. They're hot because of their large velocity dispersions, typically for 0.1 eV mass, something like 1,000 kilometers per second at redshift zero. We know pretty much exactly, provided we know the temperature of neutrinos. We know their number density. However, we do not know exactly their mass density, because it depends on how massive the neutrinos are. And so for typical upper bounds, so this slightly saturates, well, slightly beyond actually the current upper bounds, neutrinos make a fraction of a small percentage of the dark matter today, for you to give an idea. So what do neutrinos do on large-scale structure? So there's a characteristic scale, which is the characteristic distance that neutrinos can travel in a Hubble time, the free streaming scale. So on scales which are larger than this scale, neutrinos essentially behave like a cold dark matter. So they will cluster, just like the cold dark matter. They will contribute to the gravitational potentials. On scales which are smaller than this free streaming scale, neutrinos free stream out of gravitational potentials, and so they do not cluster, and on top of this, they do not, because of this, they do not contribute to the potentials. And so this will slow down the growth of the perturbations of cold dark matter itself. So this is actually the biggest effect of neutrinos, is that not only they are not clustered, but also they slow down how fast the cold dark matter grows, because it can only grow under its own gravity. So this leads to a suppression, a scale-dependent suppression of the fluctuations. So here I'm showing the ratio of the matter power spectrum when there are massive neutrinos to the matter power spectrum where neutrinos are massless. And as you crank up the mass of the neutrinos, you crank up the fraction of the dark matter that is hot, and you increase the suppression on small scales relative to large scales. So this is how one can set limits and hopefully eventually observe or measure the mass of neutrinos. So this figure here is computed in the linear regime, meaning that one is assuming that the dark matter and neutrinos all behave according to linear theory. And in this regime, the suppression is something like 8 times the fraction of neutrinos. However, most of the current and future probes of neutrinos actually rely on scales which are mildly to fully nonlinear. So for example, the Lyman alpha forests, the observable is the fluctuations of the Lyman alpha flux. So we're talking about clumps of neutral hydrogen, which themselves are nonlinear objects, and we're measuring how they cluster on scales which are also mildly nonlinear. So one needs to understand beyond the linear regime how neutrinos cluster, i.e. on scales where the fluctuation of the dark matter is greater than unity. So the standard approach to tackle this problem is to treat neutrinos with the same tools that people have developed for the last decades to treat dark matter, cold dark matter, i.e. use n-body simulations. So include neutrinos as numerical particles in n-body codes. And so several authors have been working on this in the last several years. There are, this implementation is actually very challenging. So first of all, neutrinos, even though they're non-relativistic today, they're still really fast, and they're even faster earlier in time. So in principle, if you really follow the rules, the Courant conditions, you should have a very, very small time step in your simulation. Or you could start the simulation at a later time. However, then you may not resolve the dark matter clustering correctly. And so this is a problem. Also, an additional problem is that the dark matter, the cold dark matter, being cold means that its phase space is actually a three-dimensional sheet in six-dimensional phase space, whereas neutrinos have a fully six-dimensional phase space. So if you really want to sample the 6D phase space, in principle, you need a lot more particles for neutrinos. And finally, something that I will show you more visually, neutrinos, because they don't cluster very much, and because they have this large velocity, so they essentially redistribute themselves randomly, there is a large numerical shot noise associated with having a finite number of neutrino particles in your simulation. So this is illustrating how the shot noise looks. So this is a simulation by Rossi et al. This is cold dark matter. You see the halos, the filaments, something like 3 orders of magnitude in density contrasts. In contrast, the neutrinos here, you see that you have something like 0.1 to 0.2 orders of magnitude in density fluctuations, and this is for a rather high neutrino mass. So you do recognize some real structure, so this halo here of neutrinos corresponds to a halo of dark matter, but most of the graininess that you see in this figure is actually completely artificial numerical shot noise. So let's look at some characteristic scales before going further. So here I'm showing, in wave numbers, the nonlinear scale, so estimated by saying the scale at which the characteristic fluctuation is of order unity, as a function of redshift. So this nonlinear scale becomes larger as time progresses, so the wave number is larger at earlier times. So simply put, whatever is below this curve, the cold dark matter, hence the neutrino component, is linear. These three curves here are the free streaming scales for different neutrino masses. And so whatever is above these curves here, smaller scales, neutrinos free stream for scales which are smaller. So the main message here is that these two regions overlap. So if I take at any redshift, so especially at high redshifts, I cut across here, you have linear regime where everything is linear, and then free streaming regime where neutrino fluctuations are suppressed by a factor of 1 over k squared compared to that of cold dark matter. So because of this overlap, we expect neutrinos to be unclustered on all scales. And so with this expectation, and which we confirmed, we implemented the following method with Simeon. So first of all, we do use the full numerical solver for the cold dark matter and for the gas. If we want to evolve the gas, we use some hydrocode. However, for the neutrinos, we can just solve analytically for essentially their trajectories, hence their phase space density, hence their overdensity, and the limit of small deflections. I.e., we basically solve for a linear response function of the neutrinos to the gravitational potential. This gravitational potential here is the fully nonlinear gravitational potential sourced by the nonlinear perturbations of dark matter and baryons. We then evolve this gravitational potential by sourcing it from the Poisson equation from both the cold dark matter and the neutrinos. So to sum up, we evolve neutrinos and dark matter self-consistently, accounting for mutual gravitational interactions. We use the full numerical solver for the cold dark matter and the gas, but we use a one-line equation, basically, for neutrinos. So how does that fare? So the black curve here again, I'm showing the suppression, the relative suppression of the power spectrum. So the dashed black line is what you saw before in the linear regime. And the two other lines are the difference, is what happens in the nonlinear regime. So this is why you see that this difference is important, that this is why one has to really understand nonlinear corrections. Also, what you can see is that this fully particle method and our new method agree very well. So quantitatively, the difference is less than 0.2% at redshift zero, and is even better at higher redshift. And this number is actually lower than the estimated convergence error of the codes. So the bottom line is that we replace something like 100 million to a billion numerical particles with a simple one-line equation. There are a few cheats, of course, I can tell you about if you're interested to make it fully work, but it works very well. There's no shot noise issue because there's no numerical particles, and it matches the results extremely well for the matter power spectrum. And if anyone here does n-body simulations, Simeon made a patch for Gadget publicly available. There's one limitation of principle, which is that, so here I'm showing lots of curves. Linear cold dark matter, nonlinear cold dark matter obtained from n-body simulation, fully linear neutrinos, semi-nonlinear neutrinos, which is our work, which basically accounts for the nonlinear clustering of dark matter and the linear responses of neutrinos to that nonlinear clustering. And what we notice here is that neutrinos actually cluster beyond that linear response. Okay? The delta square of neutrino is still much less than unity. However, there's some nonlinear clustering. So the reason, I think, is that we have taken all neutrinos as a single fluid, a single component, not fluid. However, neutrinos have very different velocities, so we have integrated over the velocities. But if you really look at velocity by velocity bin, so this is the neutrino power spectrum, A computed numerically by having tracer neutrino particles in an n-body code, and B computed with some analytic approximation which improves on what we had before, whereas velocity by velocity bin. And you can see that if neutrinos have today an unperturbed velocity of, say, 200 kilometers per second, which is rather small, then they do cluster nonlinearly. Whereas if for neutrinos which are fast, our analytic approximation works. So all this to say that neutrinos are not homogeneous. You always have a fraction of neutrinos that are arbitrarily cold, and those ones will cluster significantly. And this is what we're missing, I think, in this first paper. So what we're working on now is some hybrid method where we will split neutrinos in different velocity bins. OK, so this was the sort of first technical part of the talk that I had your attention. Now we're going to go into more and more less technical parts. So first of all, I'm going to talk about dark matter interactions with standard model particles. And prospects have, we can measure this from the spectrum of the CMB and from 21 centimeter fluctuations. So the general idea here is that, as a lot of you, I'm sure, work on this, the hope is that dark matter interacts somewhat beyond gravitationally with the standard model, in which case we could either try and produce this in colliders or detect it through indirect detection through its annihilations or through direct detection through interaction with standard model particles. And this is this route that I'm exploring here. So there are, of course, very stringent limits on dark matter interactions with standard model particles from Earth-based direct detection experiments. So typically, these experiments set very stringent limits, but only up to masses beyond a few GeV for the dark matter. And the reason is that the dark matter particle needs to be heavy enough to impart sufficient recoil to the target nuclei. There are also limits on dark matter electron scattering. There was a recent, a nice paper by Ruven, Essig, and collaborators, where they suggested that we could also look for dark matter ionizing or exciting the atoms in the target nuclei. And so because it's easier to ionize an electron than to give a recoil to a heavy nucleus, you can actually probe these interactions down to masses of a few MeV. Okay. However, for lower masses, there's basically no constraints. Also, in both of these cases, translating the measurement into constraints relies very strongly on what you assume for the local, on Earth, phase-space distribution of the dark matter, its local density and velocity dispersion. There are also limits on the dark matter scattering with baryons, from which are not as stringent, but which are cleaner in some sense, from cosmic microwave background anisotropy in large-scale structure. So the basic idea is that if the dark matter scatters with baryons, there will be a momentum exchange, so there will be a friction force between the dark matter and the baryons. And so this will lead to a suppression, as shown here, of the power spectrum on small scales, either at the level of the matter power spectrum or the CMB anisotropy. And so this was used by several authors to set limits on constraints of the dark matter, on interactions of the dark matter with baryons. So CMB anisotropies probe only some range of scales. They probe only wave numbers which are less than something like 0.2 inverse megaparsecs. And that corresponds to modes that enter the horizon at redshifts less than 60,000 or so. So anything that happens before this will not really affect the CMB anisotropy. The Lyman alpha forests probes smaller scales, so higher redshifts. But again, anything that happens even before redshift of a few hundred thousand could evade any of the constraints from CMB anisotropy or large-scale structure. So you could still hide interactions that were strong at early time and decayed later on. So let me show you how. So this is work with Jens Klub and Mark Amirkowski. I'm going to show you how the dark matter, if it scatters with standard model particles, can actually distort the blackbody spectrum of the CMB. So lightning review on CMB spectral distortion. So we know from Kobe Firas that the CMB is a blackbody within 50 parts in a million. This earned them the Nobel Prize in 2006. Why is this interesting? So if the CMB was distorted, or the absence of distortions, tells us something about the thermal history of the universe. So if you inject heat into the photon baryon plasma at very high redshift, redshifts greater than about 2 million, or times earlier than about 2 months, this heat will become will fully thermalize. And basically, this will just raise the temperature of the CMB, but will be unobservable at the level of spectral distortions. There are other observables. If you really mess up the temperature, you will change BBN, things like this. But for spectral distortions, it's unobservable. If you inject heat at later times, it gets either partially to not at all thermalized, so you will distort the spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. And depending on when you inject the heat, the shape of the distortion will be different. You can have a chemical potential at early times, then a Compton Y, Sunyaev-Zadovich type distortion at late times. And so the shape is basically a chronometer on the injection time. And the amplitude of the distortion, which is what I'm going to use here for the order of magnitude estimate, tells us about the fractional energy injected into the CMB. So there are many processes that were studied that can generate spectral distortions. Some of them happen in the standard universe. So for example, the fact that photons have a finite mean free path, so the acoustic waves will dissipate, so this will lead to a distortion. The adiabatic cooling of baryons, which is actually very similar to the effect I'm about to describe. Sunyaev-Zadovich effect. Jens Klub and I worked a lot on hydrogen and helium recombination spectrum, which is a tiny distortion, but is here for sure in the universe. And then you have more speculative things, for example, if you have primordial magnetic fields, or if the dark matter annihilates or decays, then it can heat up the CMB. Now, I'm not going to talk about annihilating, and I really emphasize this because it's different. I'm not going to talk about annihilating or decaying dark matter, but about dark matter that elastically scatters with standard model particles. So how does it work? So the photon barium plasma, if it decays, the temperature cools down adiabatically, the temperature would go as 1 over the scale factor. Now, if you take a non-relativistic particle, say the dark matter, its characteristic energy, or momentum squared, will go as 1 over the scale factor squared. If the dark matter, or whatever particle, scatters with photons, they will tend to exchange heat. And so because photons cool down slower, the heat flow will go from the photons to the dark matter. So the photons will tend to maintain the dark matter, to try to maintain the dark matter at the same temperature. And so the dark matter will steal some heat from the photons. So the photons will cool down slightly faster than they would adiabatically, with going as 1 over the A to 1 plus epsilon, where this epsilon is the ratio of the number density of dark matter particles to photons in number density. What if the dark matter scatters with electrons instead of photons? Well, electrons are themselves very tightly coupled thermally to the photons. And so basically, you will have an indirect thermal exchange between the dark matter and the photons. The dark matter scatters with electrons, and then the photons with the electrons. So the photons will still lose heat to the dark matter indirectly. Same thing if the dark matter scatters with nuclei. You have two levels of indirect heat coupling, but the same thing because of Compton and Coulomb scattering. Okay, so the spectral distortion is proportional to this quantity, the fractional energy injected into the CMB, which you just work out the numbers will be this epsilon factor, so the ratio of the number density of the dark matter particles to the number density of photons times log of some initial redshift to...
Where is the coupling constant?
I will be just 30 seconds. This, we don't know the number density of dark matter. We know the mass density, so this is inversely proportional to the mass. So this is why this probe will be more interesting for light dark matter particles, which cannot be probed by direct detection experiments. This maximum redshift, as I argued before, anything that happens before a redshift of 2 million stays before a redshift of 2 million, is forgotten. However, the minimum redshift is what contains the coupling. So the heat exchange between the dark matter and the photons is only efficient up to some time, which is determined by how strong the interaction is. So this decoupling time contains the cross-section and the mass of the dark matter. Okay. So if you say that this limit must be less than, this distortion is less than 50 parts in a million, as observed by Kobe Firas, and you translate this decoupling time into a cross-section, you can derive a maximum cross-section already from 20-year-old data from Kobe Firas. So these are the limits that we derive on dark matter proton, electron, or photon scattering. And so you can see that these only apply for very light dark matter particles, which are less than 0.1 MeV, because they're abundant enough to sufficiently distort the CMB. Here, in comparison, I'm showing, so this is all for velocity-independent and energy-independent scattering, but in the paper we also probed different velocity dependencies. So for velocity-independent scattering, this is comparing the dark matter electron and dark matter nucleon limits, which are much lower in absolute value, but are in a completely different mass range. Okay, so that's the neat thing, I think, is that we can probe this very low masses. And now if you change this number to 10 minus 8, so this proposed experiment, PIXI, proposes to measure CMB spectrum to 10 minus 8 precision, then you would push these limits to higher masses, and you could perhaps not close the gap because this, again, this is lower, but you could probe masses that are still not probed by direct detection experiment. I also want to emphasize that no direct detection experiment probes the dark matter photon, as far as I know. So this is all done for sort of parametrized velocity dependencies, et cetera. So what I would like to do next is really to apply this to specific dark matter models and see how it fares compared to other probes. Sorry?
It looks like there's some
cutoff here. There is always, here. Because this depends on the number density of dark matter particles, if you have such a high mass that this prefactor is less, you know, this is going to be too small, you're never going to reach, even if the dark matter is coupled forever, you're never going to reach 10 minus 8, say, distortion. That's why. from just the dark matter on the dark matter. It's like KV-ish, right? But I don't know exactly what goes into this, what assumptions go in there. Yeah. I mean, this is, I'm not saying that this is the best constraint, because I'm sure, for example, the effective number of neutrinos and things like this for specific models can kill it, but that's why I would like to look at specific models. But from an independent point of view, it's a new independent limit. So now I'm going to briefly talk about this paper with a student, Julien Munoz and Eli Kovetz, on, again, dark matter if it scatters with baryons, but now a different kind of interaction that, instead of being more important at high redshifts, would be more important at low redshifts, specifically if you have a Coulomb-type interaction. So basic review of 21 centimeter fluctuation. So once the hydrogen, once the universe recombines, the only really direct observable you could have is to look at the transition at 21 centimeter of the hyperfine split ground state level of hydrogen. I'm going to just describe a few terms that I'm going to use. So the spin temperature describes the ratio of the abundance of hydrogen between these two states, hyperfine states. And the spin temperature lies between the gas temperature and the CMB temperature, which at redshift less than about 200 are different, are not in equilibrium. And which at redshifts greater than about 10 or 20, the gas temperature is always less than the CMB temperature. So collisions tend to drive the spin temperature towards the gas temperature, and radiative transition tends to push the spin temperature this way. Okay. So then the basic idea is that one uses the CMB as a background light source, and then you have neutral hydrogen in the early universe intergalactic medium that has some spin temperature and some optical depth. And the brightness temperature, so the observable, is the difference between the intensity after crossing this cloud, cloud-ish, minus the input background temperature. And it's basically linear in the small optical depth. And the optical depth times the difference of spin minus CMB temperature. So this is just a very quick review. So if you have dark matter colliding, scattering with baryons, you will have a heat exchange again, just like for the, in the case of the CMB spectrum. So here I'm just writing the evolution equation for the baryon temperature. So there's a Compton scattering term, which tends to couple the baryon temperature with the CMB temperature. And then you will have an additional term coupling the CMB, the baryon temperature with the dark matter temperature, and a similar evolution equation for the dark matter. So this was already pointed out by Tashiro et al. In 2014. What we added in the paper, which turns out to be the dominant effect, is that baryons in dark matter have large relative velocities. Okay? And actually, the kinetic energy in the relative velocity, so these relative velocities are supersonic, meaning that the kinetic energy in the bulk flows is actually larger than the thermal energy. And so these big relative velocities actually, if the dark matter scatters off the baryons, will dissipate into heat in such a way to conserve the total kinetic energy. And so this first equation will be modified. First of all, the rate here will depend on the local value of the relative velocity, because it's a velocity-dependent cross-section. And secondly, you will have an additional strictly positive heating term due to the dissipation of these bulk flows. So as a consequence, the gas temperature, and hence the spin temperature, and hence the brightness temperature, which is observable, will depend on the local value of the baryon dark matter relative velocity, and actually depend quite strongly. So this is for a cross-section that roughly saturates the current CMB bounds. And if you, so this is the standard result without dark matter baryon scattering. And if you have dark matter baryon scattering, but without a relative velocity versus with a relative velocity, you can see that you actually change significantly the brightness temperature. One more ingredient. Dark matter and baryons have so relative velocities that fluctuate on large scales. So on scales which are larger than the horizon scale at recombination, baryons behave just like dark matter, so there's no relative velocity. And then the velocities both go as 1 over k on very small scales, and so you also suppress the relative velocity at very small scales. So in a previous paper with Don Mierberg and Sihan Yuan, we explored the consequences of this relative velocity on the standard 21 centimeter signal at high redshift. And Renan here has worked a lot on the lower redshift effects of relative velocities. So here, again, because if the dark matter scatters with the baryons, and you have relative velocities, this is a fact of the universe you cannot change, then the signal will depend on the local relative velocity. And then because of these relative velocities fluctuate on large scales, you will induce a large scale fluctuation of 21 centimeter. I can repeat this after if it's not very clear. So the bottom line is that if the dark matter scatters, you pick up this additional large scale fluctuation here. And so we did some estimates. So this is mostly at that point an exercise, because neither of these realistic nor optimistic instruments exist yet. But say, if you have something like the SKA with a few kilometer baseline and a 2% cover fraction, you could already set limits on this interaction, which are better than the current bounds from the CMB. And if you are super optimistic, but this is Perimeter Institute, so we can be crazy, then you could have much tighter bounds on this cross section. Okay, so the take-home message is that this is one of the examples of what you could do with high redshift 21 centimeter, and in general, in anything you consider, it will significantly improve on other observables. And I should add that here we really did try to account for foregrounds, from the synchrotron foreground. So this is somewhat a realistic estimate. All right, I think I went a little fast, but it's okay. So this is probably what will interest people more. Did LIGO detect dark matter? So this is based on a paper with lots of us at Hopkins. And I also will talk about some work in preparation, where I'll slightly diverge from the paper. So the basic idea. So we talked about dark matter being a possible new particle that interacts with standard model particles, hopefully. But dark matter could also be a macro particle, like a black hole. So this is an old idea, of course. And you can see many papers by Carr and recent reviews by Carr. I'm not going to get into any of the details of how these black holes are produced. This is not my area of expertise. And I'm taking more of a phenomenological approach here. So there are, of course, very various constraints on the abundance of primordial black holes. There are constraints from microlensing, from wide binaries. And there is a window where primordial black holes are neither excluded by microlensing nor wide binary constraints, which is right around 30 solar masses, which is exactly the mass that was detected by LIGO. Wow, what a coincidence. Before going further, I want to say that there are actually limits around 30 solar mass black holes. And actually, if you believe them, they're very, very strong limits. So I want to discuss this before going further. So first of all, there's this paper by Ricotti, Ostreicher, and Mack, where they set limits from the CMB on primordial black hole abundance. And these limits, as I said, are really stringent. So around 30 solar mass from the CMB, the most stringent one is from the CMB spectral distortion from FIRAS. And if you look at this number, it's something like a few times to the minus 4. And from the CMB, something like 10 to the minus 3. So I want to address this first. So what are the ingredients in deriving these limits? So the idea is that if you have primordial black holes, they will accrete gas. As a simple estimate of how fast they accrete gas, we can use the Bondi-Hoyle accretion rate. And you can convince yourself that dimensionally, this is what you expect. And here again, this is the sound speed, and this is the relative velocity. So this formula is exact analytic if V equals 0, and then it's some kind of empirical fit for V non-zero. A fraction of this accreted baryon mass will be re-radiated through some complex astrophysics that I'm not an expert in. You will have some accretion disk, something, and then you will radiate some part of the energy. Okay, at most, with the Eddington luminosity. So there is some efficiency epsilon. A fraction of this energy itself will be deposited into the plasma in the form of heat or ionizations. Okay, so the you're absolutely right. It's the minimum. Yes.
Damn it.
The maximum, yes. Thanks. Yes. Thanks. So the energy deposition per unit volume will be the fraction of the dark matter in terms of primordial black holes times the number density of primordial black holes times the luminosity of each one of them. Then this luminosity will A, distort the CMB, so exactly the same equation I wrote before. To estimate the distortion, you take the energy injected per unit time per unit volume, divided by the CMB energy density, you integrate over time, and this gives you the estimate of the distortion. And B, it will also ionize the universe more than what you expect. So the energy, again, to get an estimate, you take the energy density per unit time radiated by these primordial black holes, divided by the ionization energy, divided by the number density of baryons. So this is what is used, for example, to set limits on annihilating dark matter from CMB anisotropy observables. So what I'm working on now is to really check this and revise this bound. So first of all, I don't like saying this, but there seems to be a numerical error in the CMB spectrum bound. And it's very easy to check. I just invite you to do it. Take Eddington luminosity, plug it back here, and it just doesn't work. So it happens. We have a numerical error in our paper, so it happens to everyone. Secondly, the Bondi Hoyle formula depends on the relative velocity of baryons and dark matter. And in this paper, the relative velocity was largely underestimated. So that leads to a significant overestimate of the accretion rate, which goes as 1 over Vq. So I'm in the process of working on this, but I expect the bounds to significantly loosen to something like a few percent if you keep otherwise the same assumptions. But this is work in progress. Sorry? I didn't get the chance. I mean, I haven't finished, but I'm going to, of course, send it to them. I want to have some final result. I also want to update with Planck and do a proper Fisher analysis and everything. But besides just checking this, because, OK, I think it will still be a constraint, I think what's important to realize that there's lots of astrophysical uncertainties in deriving this bound. And if we really want to say for sure the dark matter is excluded, we want to take the most conservative approach. So I would like to also get a bound with some error bars on the bound and really ask what is the most conservative limit.
At what redshift is that accretion happening,
at redshift, several thousands or?
Before a combination.
Right, so the bound from the spectrum, which again I think is not existent, I mean, there is some bound, but it's much, much weaker, comes from like redshifts of 10,000 or something. If you go even beyond 10,000, then the accretion is suppressed by a photon drag. And the bound on from recombination, just like for dark matter annihilation, actually comes mostly from the low redshift tail of the ionization history. Another recent limit that appeared after a paper is by Tim Brandt at the IIS. So it's a very nice paper where he points out that, so looking at a particular dwarf galaxy, Eridanus II, that contains a star cluster, that if the dark matter inside this dwarf galaxy is made of machos, then it would heat up the star cluster. And by knowing how old the cluster is, we can set some limit on the abundance of dark matter. So Tim has a very clear section on all the caveats associated with this bound, which around 30 solar masses is something like 15 to 20%. So again, I don't think one can, with 99% confidence, exclude 30 solar mass primordial black holes from being the dark matter. And I don't really like the idea, but I'm just saying, I don't think we can exclude it. So with this preliminary thoughts, what is the basic idea of our paper? So if you have two primordial black holes that pass by each other on a hyperbolic orbit, if they pass close enough, then just like electrons and protons recombine through radiative recombination, you know, two black holes can recombine, become bound through gravitational wave radiation. And so there is a well-known cross-section for this process, a standard result. And it scales as the Schwarzschild radius squared and velocity to the minus 18th seventh. You can derive this from the quadrupole formula. We have not accounted for three-body captures, so it means we're underestimating the rate of binary formation here. However, three-body captures, first of all, well, we didn't account for it also because it's more complicated to calculate, but also because it tends to form wide binaries, which are more easily disrupted and which tend to merge in a very long time. Whereas gravitational wave, so binaries that are formed through gravitational wave radiation tend to be tighter and to merge really quickly. Then you plug in this cross section here, and if you take a given halo, given density, given volume, you integrate just like people do for dark matter annihilation. You get a rate of binary formation, which basically is the merger rate, because again, this binaries merge very quickly. So if you assume that the halo is virialized, you can show that this scales in such a way as a function of mass and density. And then to get the total merger rate per unit volume, you integrate this rate per halo over the mass function. Okay, so that's the basic idea in the paper. So this is where I'm going to slightly diverge from the paper, and I have to say that not everyone agrees with me here, so I take full responsibility for what's next. Yes?
Is that
Well, it's velocity dispersion. I don't think it goes to zero. I don't think so. Right. Yeah, yeah. So we have some simplifying. Yes. Well, but this is again not circle. It's the velocity dispersion. So even at the center of the halo, you'll have. I don't think so. No. I mean, you will have things that are on almost radial R orbits, right? That pass through the center of the halo. But I'm sure that it could be divergent for some profiles, the integral. I mean, we made some assumptions on the. So yeah, this is where this is not exactly as in paper. Again, so I take full responsibility for this. So what we neglected in the paper is that, okay, the integral is actually dominated by the smallest halos. At the very smallest scales, Poisson fluctuations dominate. So now if the dark matter is made of these 30 solar mass black holes, you will have, in addition to the primordial inflation power spectrum, you will have huge Poisson fluctuations, actually, that for 30 solar mass black holes will dominate starting for halo masses less than about 10 to the 6 solar masses. So the Poisson fluctuation is just this square root, 1 over the square root of the number of particles in the halo. And then these are the primordial ones, and then they grow, as Nyayesh had a paper on this, where they looked at the effect of Poisson fluctuations on Lyman alpha forest. OK, so then to estimate properties of these halos, let's say that they all collapse roughly when the variance is the critical density, the critical variance of 1.69. Of course, in practice, there will be a whole distribution of collapse signs. But as a first approximation, let's assume this. Then I will assume for simplicity that once the halo collapse, its characteristic density is something like 200 times the mean dark matter density at the time of collapse. Very simple approximation. Something that one has to account for is that halos, if they're very dense, they will evaporate quickly. So what does it mean, evaporate? So the idea is that once halo virialized means that they essentially thermalize. So you have some Maxwell-Boltzmann velocity dispersion. So you always have some fraction of the velocities that are larger than the escape velocity. And you always replenish this fraction because the particles thermalize in a fast time scale. So this is a classic Benin-Tremaine, the evaporation timescale. You plug that in, plug this in, and you find that basically for halos which contain more than 1,000 objects, the evaporation time becomes longer than the Hubble time. Okay, so said differently, halos containing less than about 1,000 primordial black holes, again consistent with Nyash et al. Paper, will evaporate in the Hubble time. So we're gonna just cut off the integral around these halos. So at this limit, you're just plugging the numbers, this sigma v, et cetera, and you get something like 10 to minus 13 per year per halo. And if you ask how abundant these halos are, I'm going to take the Preschecker formalism, and I get something like 0.5 times 10 to the 13 per gigayear cube for these halos. I multiply these two numbers, and I get final result, which is a volumic rate of primordial black hole mergers, if they are the dark matter, of something like half per gigaparsec cube per year. And this is really all the assumptions that I just listed here. So this is not within the LIGO window, but it's damn close, okay, given all these assumptions. So the LIGO window is something like 2 to 53 gigaparsec cube per year that they estimated from one single event. So I'm sure this number will change with time. But so, this is not 5 orders of magnitude off. So that's, I think it's kind of neat. Okay, so that's the main result of the paper is that if the dark matter is made of 30 solar mass primordial black holes, if you can justify that the current bounds can be evaded or not robust enough, which at the very least justifies still thinking about it, then the rate that you obtain is broadly consistent with something of order unity per gigaparsec cube per year. So this got us a lot of press, but my favorite part is the fan mail. So we got this a couple of days ago. I'm so happy, primordial black holes equals black matter, black energy. And when I heard about the publication of heretical theory, I pumped my fist and yelled out, yes! Onward and upward, valiant astrophysics warriors. So thank you for your attention. I will briefly recap. So I talked first about maybe somewhat the technical part, which is how you implement the effect of massive neutrinos on the formation of large-scale structure in the nonlinear regime. And I explained to you how you can do this with a sort of analytic method. Then I talked about how the dark matter, if it scatters with standard model particles, can distort the CMB spectrum. So the CMB spectrum can play the role of a direct detection experiment, which is kind of neat. And also, once we measure 21 centimeter fluctuation from the dark ages, we'll also be able to probe dark matter baryon scattering. And finally, our heretic idea that if the dark matter is made of primordial black holes of 30 solar masses, the merger rates that you infer from very simple assumptions that still remain to be worked in more details is broadly consistent with the window inferred by the LIGO collaboration from the detected event. So thank you very much.
Hey, there's time for a few questions.
Indicated as an option?
I mean, it depends how much their window changes. I don't think their estimated rate will change so dramatically.
I mean, you have this, you predicted a particular distribution that is sharply picked.
Oh, right.
If LIGO shows nature is more democratic, would you throw it out the window?
Again, I'm not advocating for primordial black holes beyond being some kind of acute, interesting idea. I don't think that there's a peak, a delta function of 30 solar mass black holes as a dark matter. If it's a rather narrow window, our results basically remain the same. It's not going to change very much. If it's a completely broad window, then of course it would change a lot. It would be interesting to work out, if the dark matter is made of black holes of many different masses, what is the rate that we would get?
So I guess just to comment on Luis's question that I don't think there is any process that would give you just a sharp mass of primordial black hole. There is always a range that comes from press sector or something like that. Yeah.
But perhaps there could be like some broad.
Of course, there would be a range. Yeah, there would be a range. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess my second question is one process that you didn't mention that does happen prior to evaporation of these clusters is the so-called core collapse.
Okay.
Which is basically saying that if you want a self-gravitating gas of particles to reach thermal equilibrium, in fact, there is no stable thermal equilibrium, and the center becomes in the fluid limit, it becomes singular. It becomes singular as a thermal sphere. In the actual case of discrete particles, what people think happens and simulations show that is that you form hard binaries that basically prevent core collapse because, of course, you cannot make singular distributions out of discrete particles. Now, I wonder whether that might be a mode of binary formation which is not included captured by this formula, basically, because you have this density. Density becomes much higher than the average density at the center, and that drives formation of hard binaries that, of course, could be more easily merging due to gravitational waves. So I think that's the suggestion that might drive up the number, in fact.
Okay, yeah.
Cool.
Hey. Yes, I had a question on your first point of neutrinos as hot dark matter. Okay. Obviously, neutrinos exist. They have a mass, just a matter of... Okay.
I guess, you know, I don't have to go back. Yeah. Or did you have a specific question?
Yes.
You want me to go back?
Okay. Yes, on that. So how, I mean, obviously, so you're talking about of order a percent effect on the nonlinear dark matter or the total mass fluctuations,
yes,
at some k of 0.1 or higher. How would you ever measure that? I mean, wouldn't you have to control baryonic physics to 10% of, you know, baryons make up 10 times more than densities in neutrinos. Wouldn't you have to understand?
So there's a great way you can do it is because of the relative velocity of neutrinos and dark matter, and you can measure the local quadrupole. I think it's Whaley-Penn who worked it out. No, I don't know exactly. I agree with you, especially for Lyman alpha forests. What are the actual uncertainties in the prediction? That's not my area of expertise here, so I don't know.
Okay, I think I'll have to cut it off there. Before we thank Yassine again, I'll just remind you that we'll coffee break now. We'll come back here at 11:20 for a special announcement by the Premier of Ontario. If you come back, I ask that you sit in these rows right here for the conference seating. And if you are not currently sitting in one of these rows right here for the conference seating and you have stuff, you need to take it with you, okay? Because people will be occupying these seats up here and those seats down there. So thank you again, Yassine.
Thank you.